This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of From Dead to Worse by Charlaine Harris, narrated by Johanna Parker. This book is copyrighted 2008 by Charlaine Harris, Incorporated. This recording is copyrighted 2008 by Recorded Books. Suki Stackhouse, mind-reading cocktail waitress from Louisiana, has had much to contend with in her life. It's bad enough having boy trouble with vampires and shapeshifters without having to deal with unexpected supernatural surprises. And now, From Dead to Worse.
If this was the Lord of the Rings, and I had a smart British voice like Cate Blanchett, I could tell you the background of the events of that fall in a really suspenseful way, and you'd be straining to hear the rest. But what happened in my little corner of Northwest Louisiana wasn't an epic story. The Vampire War was more of the nature of a small country takeover, and the Were War was like a border skirmish. Even in the annals of supernatural America, I guess they exist somewhere, they were minor chapters. Unless you were actively involved in the takeovers and skirmishes. Then they became pretty damn major. And everything was due to Katrina, the disaster that just kept on spreading grief, woe, and permanent change in its wake. Before Hurricane Katrina, Louisiana had a flourishing vampire community. In fact, the vampire population of New Orleans had burgeoned, making it the place to go if you wanted to see vampires, and lots of Americans did. The undead jazz clubs, featuring musicians no one had seen playing in public in decades, were special draws. Vamp strip clubs, vamp psychics, vamp sex acts, secret and not-so-secret places where you could get bitten and have an orgasm on the spot. All this was available in southern Louisiana. In the northern part of the state, not so much. I live in the northern part, in a small town called Bon Ton. But even in my area, where vamps are relatively thin on the ground, the undead were making economic and social strides. All in all, vampire business in the Pelican State was booming. But then came the death of the King of Arkansas, while his wife, the Queen of Louisiana, was entertaining him soon after their wedding. Since the corpse vanished and all the witnesses, except me, were supernaturals, human law took no notice. But the other vampires did, and the Queen, Sophie Anne LeClaire, landed in a very dicey legal position. Then came Katrina, which wiped out the financial base of Sophie Anne's empire. Still, the Queen was floundering back from those disasters when another one followed hard on their heels. Sophie Anne and some of her strongest adherents, and me, Suki Stackhouse, telepath and human, were caught in a terrible explosion in Rhodes, the destruction of the vampire hotel called the Pyramid of Giza. A splinter group of the Fellowship of the Sun claimed responsibility, and while the leaders of that anti-vampire church decried the hate crime, everyone knew that the Fellowship was hardly agonizing over those who were terribly wounded in the blast, much less over the, finally, absolutely dead vampires or the humans who served them. Sophie Anne lost her legs, several members of her entourage, and her dearest companion. Her life was saved by her half-demon lawyer, Mr. Cataliades, but her recuperation time was going to be lengthy, and she was in a position of terrible vulnerability. What part did I play in all this? I'd helped save lives after the pyramid went down, and I was terrified I was now on the radar of people who might want me to spend my time in their service, using my telepathy for their purposes. Some of those purposes were good, and I wouldn't mind lending a hand in rescue services from time to time, but I wanted to keep my life to myself. I was alive. My boyfriend, Quinn, was alive, and the vampires most important to me had survived too. As far as the trouble Sophie Anne faced, the political consequences of the attack, and the fact that supernatural groups were circling the weakened state of Louisiana like hyenas around a dying gazelle, I didn't think about it at all. I had other stuff on my mind, personal stuff. I'm not used to thinking much further than the edge of my fingertips. That's my only excuse. Not only was I not thinking about the vampire situation, there was another supernatural situation I didn't ponder that turned out to be just as crucial to my future. Close to Bonton, in Shreveport, there's a wear pack whose ranks are swollen by the men and women from Barksdale Air Force Base. During the past year, this wear pack had become sharply divided between two factions. I'd learned in American history what Abraham Lincoln, quoting the Bible, had to say about houses divided. To assume that these two situations would work themselves out, to fail to foresee that their resolution would involve me, well, that was where I was almost fatally blind. I'm telepathic, not psychic. Vampire minds are big, relaxing blanks to me. Wares are difficult to read, though not impossible. That's my only excuse for being unaware of the trouble brewing all around me. What was I so busy thinking about? Weddings. And my missing boyfriend. Chapter 1. I was making a neat arrangement of liquor bottles on the folding table behind the portable bar when Hallie Robinson rushed up, her normally sweet face flushed and tear-streaked. Since she was supposed to be getting married within an hour and was still wearing blue jeans and a t-shirt, she got my immediate attention.
"Sookie," she said, rounding the bar to grab my arm, "you have to help me."
I'd already helped her by putting on my bartending clothes instead of the party dress I'd planned on wearing. "Sure," I said, imagining Hallie wanted me to make her a special drink, though if I'd listened into her thoughts, I'd have known differently already. However, I was trying to be on my best behavior, and I was shielding like crazy. Being telepathic is no picnic, especially at a high-tension event like a double wedding. I'd expected to be a guest instead of a bartender, but the caterer's bartender had been in a car wreck on her way over from Shreveport, and Sam, who'd been unhired when EEE had insisted on using their own bartender, was abruptly hired again. I was a little disappointed to be on the working side of the bar, but you had to oblige the bride on her special day. "What can I do for you?" I asked.
"I need you to be my bridesmaid," she said.
What?
"Tiffany fainted after Mr. Cumberland took the first round of pictures. She's on her way to the hospital."
It was an hour before the wedding, and the photographer had been trying to get a number of group shots out of the way. The bridesmaids and the groomsmen were already togged out. Hallie should have been getting into her wedding finery, but instead, here she was in jeans and curlers, no makeup, and a tear-streaked face. Who could resist that?
"You're the right size," she said, "and Tiffany's probably just about to have her appendix out, so can you try on the dress?"
I glanced at Sam, my boss. Sam smiled at me and nodded.
"Go on, Sook. We don't officially open for business until after the wedding."
So I followed Hallie into Belle Reve, the Belle Fleur mansion, recently restored to something like its antebellum glory. The wooden floors gleamed, the harp by the stairs shone with gilt, the silverware displayed on the big sideboard in the dining room glowed with polishing. There were servers in white coats buzzing around everywhere, the EEE logo on their tunics done in an elaborate black script. Extremely elegant events had become the premier upscale caterer in the United States. I felt a stab in my heart when I noticed the logo, because my missing guy worked for the supernatural branch of EEE. I didn't have long to feel the ache, though, because Hallie was dragging me up the stairs at a relentless pace. The first bedroom at the top was full of youngish women in gold-colored dresses, all fussing around Hallie's soon-to-be sister-in-law, Portia Bellefleur. Hallie zoomed past that door to enter the second room on the left. It was equally full of younger women, but these were in midnight blue chiffon. The room was in chaos, with the bridesmaids' civilian clothes piled here and there. There was a makeup and hair station over by the west wall, staffed by a stoic woman in a pink smock, curling rod in her hand. Hallie tossed introductions through the air like paper pellets.
"Gals, this is Sookie Stackhouse. Sookie, this is my sister Faye, my cousin Kelly, my best friend Sarah, my other best friend Dana, and here's the dress. It's an 8.
I was amazed that Hallie had had the presence of mind to divest Tiffany of the bridesmaid dress before her departure for the hospital. Brides are ruthless. In a matter of minutes, I was stripped down to the essentials. I was glad I'd worn nice underwear, since there wasn't any time for modesty. How embarrassing it would have been to be in granny panties with holes. The dress was lined, so I didn't need a slip, another stroke of luck. There was a pair of thigh highs, which I pulled on, and then the dress went over my head. Sometimes I wear a 10, in fact, most of the time, so I was holding my breath while Faye zipped it up. If I didn't breathe a lot, it would be okay.
"Super,"
one of the other women, Dana, said with great happiness.
"Now the shoes."
"Oh, God," I said when I saw them. They were very high heels, dyed to match the midnight blue dress, and I slid my feet into them, anticipating pain. Kelly, maybe, buckled the straps, and I stood up. All of us held our breath as I took a step, then another. They were about half a size too small. It was an important half.
"I can get through the wedding," I said, and they all clapped.
"Over here, then," said Pink Smock, and I sat in her chair and had more makeup reapplied over my own and my hair redone, while the real bridesmaids and Hallie's mother assisted Hallie into her dress. Pink Smock had a lot of hair to work with. I've only had light trims in the past 3 years, I guess, and it's way down past my shoulder blades now. My roommate, Amelia, had put some highlights in, and that had turned out real good. I was blonder than ever. I examined myself in the full-length mirror, and it seemed impossible I could have been so transformed in 20 minutes. From working barmaid in a white ruffled tux shirt and black trousers to bridesmaid in a midnight blue dress, and 3 inches taller to boot. Hey, I looked great. The dress was a super color for me, the skirt was gently A-line, the short sleeves weren't too tight, and it wasn't low-cut enough to look slutty. With my boobs, the slut factor kicks in if I'm not careful. I was yanked out of self-admiration by the practical Dana, who said, "Listen, here's the drill." From that moment on, I listened and nodded. I examined a little diagram. I nodded some more. Dana was one organized gal. If I ever invaded a small country, this was the woman I wanted on my side. By the time we made our way carefully down the stairs, long skirts and high heels, not a good combination, I was fully briefed and ready for my first trip down the aisle as a bridesmaid. Most girls have done this a couple of times before they reach 26, but Tara Thornton, the only friend I had close enough to ask me, had up and eloped while I was out of town. The other wedding party was assembled downstairs when we descended. Portia's group would precede Hallie's. The two grooms and their groomsmen were already outside, if all was going smoothly, because now it was 5 minutes until liftoff. Portia Bellefleur and her bridesmaids averaged 7 years older than Hallie's posse. Portia was the big sister of Andy Bellefleur, Bonton police detective, and Hallie's groom. Portia's dress was a little over the top. It was covered with pearls and so much lace and sequins, I thought it could stand by itself. But then, it was Portia's big day, and she could wear whatever she damn well pleased. All Portia's bridesmaids were wearing gold. The bridesmaids' bouquets all matched, white and dark blue and yellow.
Coordinated with the dark blue of Hallie's bridesmaid selection, the result was very pretty. The wedding planner, a thin, nervous woman with a big cloud of dark curly hair, counted heads almost audibly. When she was satisfied everyone she needed was present and accounted for, she flung open the double doors to the huge brick patio. We could see the crowd, backs to us, seated on the lawn in two sections of white folding chairs, with a strip of red carpet running between the two sides. They were facing the platform where the priest stood at an altar decked in cloth and gleaming candlesticks. To the right of the priest, Portia's groom, Glenn Vick, was waiting, facing the house. And therefore, us. He looked very, very nervous, but he was smiling. His groomsmen were already in position, flanking him. Portia's golden bridesmaids stepped out onto the patio, and one by one, they began their march down the aisle through the manicured garden. The scent of wedding flowers made the night sweet, and the Belrive roses were blooming, even in October. Finally, to a huge swell of music, Portia crossed the patio to the end of the carpet, the wedding coordinator, with some effort, lifting the train of Portia's dress so it wouldn't drag on the bricks. At the priest's nod, everyone stood and faced the rear so they could see Portia's triumphal march. She'd waited years for this. After Portia's safe arrival at the altar, it was our party's turn. Hallie gave each one of us an air kiss on the cheek as we stepped past her out onto the patio. She even included me, which was sweet of her. The wedding coordinator sent us off one by one to stand reflecting our designated groomsman up front. Mine was a Bellefleur cousin from Monroe who was quite startled to see me coming instead of Tiffany. I walked at the slow pace Dana had emphasized and held my bouquet in my clasped hands at the desired angle. I'd been watching the other maids like a hawk. I wanted to get this right. All the faces were turned to me, and I was so nervous I forgot to block. The thoughts of the crowd rushed at me in a gush of unwanted communication.
Looks so pretty.
What happened to Tiffany? Wow, what a wreck.
Hurry it up, I need a drink.
What the hell am I doing here? She drags me to every dogfight in the parish.
I love wedding cake. A photographer stepped in front of me and took a picture. It was someone I knew, a pretty werewolf named Maria Starr Cooper. She was the assistant of Al Cumberland, a well-known photographer based in Shreveport. I smiled at Maria Starr, and she took another shot. I continued down the carpet, held on to my smile, and pushed away all the racket in my head. After a moment, I noticed there were blank spots in the crowd, which signaled the presence of vampires. Glenn had requested a night wedding specifically so he could invite some of his more important vampire clients. I'd been sure Portia truly loved him when she agreed to that, because Portia didn't like bloodsuckers at all. In fact, they gave her the creeps. I kind of liked vampires in general, because their brains were closed to me. Being in their company was oddly restful. Okay, a strain in other ways, but at least my brain could relax. Finally, I arrived at my designated spot. I'd watched Portia and Glenn's attendants arrange themselves in an inverted V with a space at the front for the nuptial couple. Our group was doing the same thing. I'd nailed it, and I exhaled in relief. Since I wasn't taking the place of the maid of honor, my work was over. All I had to do was stand still and look attentive, and I thought I could do that. The music swelled to a second crescendo, and the priest gave his signal again. The crowd rose and turned to look at the second bride. Hallie began moving slowly toward us. She looked absolutely radiant. Hallie had selected a much simpler dress than Portia's, and she looked very young and very sweet. She was at least 5 years younger than Andy, maybe more. Hallie's dad, as tanned and fit as his wife, stepped out to take Hallie's arm when she drew abreast. Since Portia had come down the aisle alone, her father was long dead, it had been decided Hallie would too. After I'd had my fill of Hallie's smile, I looked over the crowd who'd rotated to follow the bride's progress. There were so many familiar faces, teachers from the elementary school where Hallie taught, members of the police department where Andy worked, the friends of old Mrs. Caroline Bellefleur who were still alive and tottering, Portia's fellow lawyers, and other people who worked in the justice system, and Glenn Vick's clients and other accountants. Almost every chair was occupied. There were a few black faces to be seen, and a few brown faces, but most of the wedding guests were middle-class Caucasians. The palest faces in the crowd were the vampires, of course. One of them I knew well. Bill Compton, my neighbor and former lover, was sitting about halfway back, wearing a tuxedo and looking very handsome. Bill managed to seem at home in whatever he chose to wear. Beside him sat his human girlfriend, Celia Pumphrey, a real estate agent from Clarice. She was wearing a burgundy gown that set off her dark hair. There were perhaps 5 vamps I didn't recognize. I assumed they were clients of Glenn's. Though Glenn didn't know it, there were several other attendees who were more and less than human. My boss, Sam, was a rare true shapeshifter who could become any animal. The photographer was a werewolf like his assistant. To all the regular wedding guests, he looked like a well-rounded, rather short African-American male wearing a nice suit and carrying a big camera. But Al turned into a wolf at the full moon, just like Maria Starr. There were a few other wares in the crowd, though only one I knew. Amanda, a red-haired woman in her late 30s who owned a bar in Shreveport called the Hair of the Dog. Maybe Glenn's firm handled the bar's books. And there was one ware panther, Calvin Norris. Calvin had brought a date I was glad to see, though I was less than thrilled after I identified her as Tanya Grissom. Bleck. What was she doing back in town? And why had Calvin been on the guest list? I liked him, but I couldn't figure out the connection. While I'd been scanning the crowd for familiar faces, Hallie had assumed her position by Andy, and now all the bridesmaids and groomsmen had to face forward to listen to the service. Since I didn't have a big emotional investment in this proceeding, I found myself mentally wandering while Father Kempton Luttrell, the Episcopal priest who ordinarily came to the little Bon Ton church once every 2 weeks, conducted the service. The lights that had been set up to illuminate the garden glinted off Father Luttrell's glasses and bleached some of the color out of his face. He looked almost like a vampire. Things proceeded pretty much on the standard plan. Boy, it was lucky I was used to standing up at the bar, because this was a lot of standing, and in high heels, too. I seldom wore heels, much less 3-inch ones. It felt strange being 5'9". I tried not to shift around, possessed my soul with patience. Now Glenn was putting the ring on Portia's finger, and Portia looked almost pretty as she looked down at their clasped hands. She'd never be one of my favorite people, nor I hers, but I wished her well. Glenn was bony and had darkish receding hair and major glasses. If you called Central Casting and ordered an accountant type, they'd send you Glenn. But I could tell directly from his brain that he loved Portia, and she loved him. I let myself shift a bit, put my weight a little more on my right leg. Then Father Luttrell started all over again on Hallie and Andy. I kept my smile pasted to my face. No problem there. I did it all the time at the bar. And watched Hallie become Mrs. Andrew Bellefleur. I was lucky. Episcopalian weddings can be long, but the two couples had opted for having the shorter form of the service. At last, the music swelled to triumphant strains, and the newlyweds exited to the house. The wedding party trailed after them in reverse order. On my way down the aisle, I felt genuinely happy and a weensy bit proud. I'd helped Hallie in her time of need, and very soon I was going to take these shoes off. From his chair, Bill caught my eye and silently put his hand over his heart. It was a romantic and totally unexpected gesture, and for a moment I softened toward him. I very nearly smiled, though Sela was right there by his side. Just in time, I reminded myself that Bill was a no-good rat bastard, and I swept on my painful way. Sam was standing a couple of yards past the last row of chairs, wearing a white tux shirt like the one I'd had on and black dress pants. Relaxed and at ease, that was Sam. Even his tangled halo of strawberry blonde hair somehow fit in. I flashed him a genuine smile, and he grinned back. He gave me a thumbs up, and though shifter brains are hard to read, I could tell he approved of the way I looked and the way I'd conducted myself. His bright blue eyes never left me. He's been my boss for 5 years, and we've gotten along great for the most part. He'd been pretty upset when I'd started dating a vampire, but he'd gotten over it. I needed to get to work, and pronto. I caught up with Dana.
When can we change? I asked.
Oh, we have pictures to do yet, Dana said cheerfully.
Her husband had come up to put his arm around her. He was holding their baby, a tiny thing swaddled in sex-neutral yellow.
Sure I won't be needed for those, I said. Y'all took a lot of pictures earlier, right? Before what's-her-name got sick?
Tiffany, yes, but there'll be more.
I seriously doubted the family would want me in them, though my absence would unbalance the symmetry in the group pictures. I found Al Cumberland.
Yes,
he said, snapping away at the brides and grooms as they beamed at each other.
I do need some shots. You gotta stay in costume.
Crap, I said, because my feet hurt.
Listen, Sookie, the best I can do is to shoot your group first. Andy? Hallie? That is, Mrs. Belfleur? If you all will come this way, let's get your pictures done.
Portia Belfleur Vick looked a little astonished that her group wasn't going first, but she had way too many people to greet to really get riled. While Maria Starr snapped away at the touching scene, a distant relative wheeled old Miss Caroline up to Portia, and Portia bent to kiss her grandmother. Portia and Andy had lived with Miss Caroline for years after their own parents had passed away. Miss Caroline's poor health had delayed the weddings at least twice. The original plan had been for last spring, and it had been a rush job because Miss Caroline was failing. She'd had a heart attack and then recovered. After that, she'd broken her hip. I had to say, for someone who'd survived 2 major health disasters, Miss Caroline looked... well, to tell the truth, she looked just like a very old lady who'd had a heart attack and a broken hip. She was all dressed up in a beige silk suit. She even had on some makeup, and her snow-white hair was arranged a la Lauren Bacall. She'd been a beauty in her day, an autocrat her entire life, and a famous cook until the recent past. Caroline Belfleur was in her 7th heaven this night. She'd married off both her grandchildren. She was getting plenty of tribute, and Belle Reeve was looking spectacular, thanks to the vampire who was staring at her with an absolutely unreadable face. Bill Compton had discovered he was the Belfleur's ancestor, and he had anonymously given Miss Caroline a whacking big bunch of money. She'd enjoyed spending it so much, and she had had no idea it had come from a vampire. She'd thought it a legacy from a distant relative. I thought it was kind of ironic that the Belfleurs would just as soon have spit on Bill as thanked him. But he was part of the family, and I was glad he'd found a way to attend. I took a deep breath, banished Bill's dark gaze from my consciousness, and smiled at the camera. I occupied my designated space in the pictures to balance out the wedding party, dodged the googly-eyed cousin, and finally hot-footed it up the stairs to change into my bartender's rig. There was no one up here, and it was a relief to be in the room by myself. I shimmied out of the dress, hung it up, and sat on a stool to unbuckle the straps of the painful shoes. There was a little sound at the door, and I looked up, startled. Bill was standing just inside the room, his hands in his pockets, his skin glowing gently. His fangs were out.
"Trying to change here," I said tartly. No point to making a big show of modesty. He'd seen every inch of me.
"You didn't tell them," he said.
"Huh?"
Then my brain caught up. Bill meant that I hadn't told the Belfleurs that he was their ancestor.
"No, of course not," I said. "You asked me not to."
"I thought, in your anger, you might give them the information."
I gave him an incredulous look. "No, some of us actually have honor," I said. He looked away for a minute. "By the way, your face healed real well."
During the Fellowship of the Sun bombing in Rhodes, Bill's face had been exposed to the sun with really stomach-churning results.
"I slept for 6 days," he said. "When I finally got up, it was mostly healed. And as for your dig about my failing in honor, I haven't any defense, except that when Sophie Anne told me to pursue you, I was reluctant, Suki. At first, I didn't want to even pretend to have a permanent relationship with a human woman. I thought it degraded me. I only came into the bar to identify you when I couldn't put it off any longer. And that evening didn't turn out like I'd planned. I went outside with the drainers, and things happened. When you were the one who came to my aid, I decided it was fate. I did what I had been told to do by my queen. In so doing, I fell into a trap I couldn't escape. I still can't."
"The trap of love," I thought sarcastically. But he was too serious, too calm to mock. I was simply defending my own heart with the weapon of bitchiness. "You got you, girlfriend," I said. "You going back to Sela?"
I looked down to make sure I'd gotten the little strap on the second sandal unlatched. I worked the shoe off. When I glanced back up, Bill's dark eyes were fixed on me.
"I would give anything to lie with you again," he said.
I froze, my hands in the act of rolling the thigh-high hose off my left leg.
Okay, that pretty much stunned me on several different levels. First, the biblical lie with. Second, my astonishment that he considered me such a memorable bed partner. Maybe he only remembered the virgins.
"I don't want to fool with you tonight, and Sam's waiting on me down there to help him tend bar," I said roughly. "You go on."
I stood and turned my back to him while I pulled on my pants and my shirt, tucking the shirt in. Then it was time for the black running shoes. After a quick check in the mirror to make sure I still had on some lipstick, I faced the doorway. He was gone. I went down the wide stairs and out the patio doors into the garden, relieved to be resuming my more accustomed place behind a bar. My feet still hurt. So did the sore spot in my heart, labeled Bill Compton. Sam gave me a smiling glance as I scurried into place. Miss Caroline had vetoed our request to leave a tip jar out, but bar patrons had already stuffed a few bills into an empty highball glass, and I intended to let that stay in position.
"You looked real pretty in the dress,"
Sam said as he mixed a rum and coke. I handed a beer across the bar and smiled at the older man who'd come to fetch it. He gave me a huge tip, and I glanced down to see that in my hurry to get downstairs, I'd skipped a button. I was showing a little extra cleavage. I was momentarily embarrassed, but it wasn't a slutty button, just a, "Hey, I've got boobs" button, so I let it be.
"Thanks," I said, hoping Sam hadn't noticed this quick evaluation. "I hope I did everything right."
"Of course you did,"
Sam said, as if the possibility of me blowing my new role had never crossed his mind. This is why he's the greatest boss I've ever had.
"Well, good evening," said a slightly nasal voice, and I looked up from the wine I was pouring to see that Tanya Grissom was taking up space and breathing air that could be better used by almost anyone else. Her escort, Calvin, was nowhere in sight.
"Hey, Tanya," Sam said. "How you doing? It's been a while."
Well, I had to tie up some loose ends in Mississippi, Tanya said. But I'm back here visiting, and I wondered if you needed any part-time help, Sam.
I pressed my mouth shut and kept my hands busy.
Tanya stepped to the side nearest Sam when an elderly lady asked me for some tonic water with a wedge of lime. I handed it to her so quickly, she looked astonished, and then I took care of Sam's next customer. I could hear from Sam's brain that he was pleased to see Tanya. Men can be idiots, right? To be fair, I did know some things about her that Sam didn't.
Selah Pumphrey was next in line, and I could only be amazed at my luck. However, Bill's girlfriend just asked for a rum and coke.
Sure, I said, trying not to sound relieved, and began putting the drink together.
I heard him, Selah said very quietly.
Heard who? I asked, distracted by my effort to listen to what Tanya and Sam were saying, either with my ears or with my brain.
I heard Bill when he was talking to you earlier.
When I didn't speak, she continued,
I snuck up the stairs after him.
Then he knows you were there, I said absently, and handed her the drink. Her eyes flared wide at me for a second. Alarmed? Angry? She stalked off. If wishes could kill, I would be lifeless on the ground. Tanya began to turn away from Sam, as if her body was thinking of leaving, but her head was still talking to my boss. Finally, her whole self went back to her date. I looked after her, thinking dark thoughts.
Well, that's good news, Sam said with a smile. Tanya's available for a while.
I bit back my urge to tell him that Tanya had made it quite clear she was available.
Oh, yeah, great, I said. There were so many people I liked. Why were two of the women I really didn't care for at this wedding tonight? Well, at least my feet were practically whimpering with pleasure at getting out of the two small heels. I smiled and made drinks and cleared away empty bottles and went to Sam's truck to unload more stock. I opened beers and poured wine and mopped up spills until I felt like a perpetual motion machine. The vampire clients arrived at the bar in a cluster. I uncorked one bottle of Royalty Blended, a premium blend of synthetic blood and the real blood of actual European royalty. It had to be refrigerated, of course, and it was a very special treat for Glenn's clients, a treat he'd personally arranged. The only vampire drink that exceeded Royalty Blended in price was the nearly pure Royalty, which contained only a trace of preservatives. Sam lined up the wine glasses. Then he told me to pour it out. I was extra special careful not to spill a drop. Sam handed each glass to its recipient. The vampires, including Bill, all tipped very heavily, big smiles on their faces as they lifted their glasses in a toast to the newlyweds. After a sip of the dark fluid in the wine glasses, their fangs ran out to prove their enjoyment. Some of the human guests looked a smidge uneasy at this expression of appreciation, but Glenn was right there, smiling and nodding. He knew enough about vampires not to offer to shake hands. I noticed the new Mrs. Vick was not hobnobbing with the undead guests, though she made one pass through the cluster with a strained smile fixed on her face. When one of the vampires came back for a glass of ordinary true blood, I handed him the warm drink.
Thank you,
he said, tipping me yet again. While he had his billfold open, I saw a Nevada driver's license. I'm familiar with a wide variety of licenses from carding kids at the bar. He'd come far for this wedding. I really looked at him for the first time. When he knew he'd caught my attention, he put his hands together and bowed slightly. Since I'd been reading a mystery set in Thailand, I knew this was a why, a courteous greeting practiced by Buddhists, or maybe just Thai people in general. Anyway, he meant to be polite. After a brief hesitation, I put down the rag in my hand and copied his movement. The vampire looked pleased.
I call myself Jonathan, he said.
Americans can't pronounce my real name.
There might have been a touch of arrogance and contempt there, but I couldn't blame him.
I'm Sookie Stackhouse, I said.
Jonathan was a smallish man, maybe 5'8", with the light copper coloring and dusky black hair of his country. He was really handsome. His nose was small and broad, his lips plump. His brown eyes were topped with absolutely straight black brows. His skin was so fine, I couldn't detect any pores. He had that little shine vampires have.
"This is your husband?"
he asked, picking up his glass of blood and tilting his head in Sam's direction. Sam was busy mixing a piña colada for one of the bridesmaids.
"No, sir, he's my boss."
Just then, Terry Belfleur, second cousin to Portia and Andy, lurched up to ask for another beer. I was real fond of Terry, but he was a bad drunk, and I thought he was well on his way to achieving that condition. Though the Vietnam vet wanted to stand and talk about the president's policy on the current war, I walked him over to another family member, a distant cousin from Baton Rouge, and made sure the man was going to keep an eye on Terry and prevent him from driving off in his pickup. The vampire Jonathan was keeping an eye on me while I did this, and I wasn't sure why. But I didn't observe anything aggressive or lustful in his stance or demeanor, and his fangs were in. It seemed safe to disregard him and take care of business. If there was some reason Jonathan wanted to talk to me, I'd find out about it sooner or later. Later was fine. As I fetched a case of Cokes from Sam's truck, my attention was caught by a man standing alone in the shadows cast by the big live oak on the west side of the lawn. He was tall, slim, and impeccably dressed in a suit that was obviously very expensive. The man stepped forward a little, and I could see his face, could realize he was returning my gaze. My first impression was that he was a lovely creature and not a man at all. Whatever he was, human wasn't part of it. Though he had some age on him, he was extremely handsome, and his hair, still pale gold, was as long as mine. He wore it pulled back neatly. He was slightly withered, like a delicious apple that had been in the crisper too long. But his back was absolutely straight, and he wore no glasses. He did carry a cane, a very simple black one with a gold head. When he stepped out of the shadows, the vampires turned as a group to look. After a moment, they slightly inclined their heads. He returned the acknowledgement. They kept their distance, as if he was dangerous or awesome. This episode was very strange, but I didn't have time to think about it. Everyone wanted one last free drink. The reception was winding down, and people were filtering to the front of the house for the leave-taking of the happy couples. Hallie and Portia had disappeared upstairs to change into their going-away outfits. The EEE staff had been vigilant about clearing up empty cups and the little plates that had held cake and finger food, so the garden looked relatively neat. Now that we weren't busy, Sam let me know he had something on his mind.
Sookie, am I getting the wrong idea, or do you dislike Tanya?
I do have something against Tanya, I said. I'm just not sure I should tell you about it. You clearly like her.
You'd think I'd been sampling the bourbon, or truth serum.
If you don't like to work with her, I want to hear the reason, he said. You're my friend. I respect your opinion.
This was very pleasant to hear. Tanya's pretty, I said. She's bright and able. Those were the good things.
And?
And she came here as a spy, I said. The Peltz sent her, trying to find out if I had anything to do with the disappearance of their daughter, Debbie. You remember when they came to the bar?
Yes,
said Sam. In the illumination that had been strung up all around the garden, he looked both brightly lit and darkly shadowed.
You did have something to do with it?
Everything, I said sadly. But it was self-defense.
I know it must have been.
He'd taken my hand. My own jerked in surprise.
I know you,
he said, and didn't let go. Sam's faith made me feel a little warm glow inside. I'd worked for Sam a long time now, and his good opinion meant a lot to me. I felt almost choked up, and I had to clear my throat.
So, I wasn't happy to see Tanya, I continued. I didn't trust her from the start, and when I found out why she'd come to Bonton, I got really down on her. I don't know if she still gets paid by the pelts. Plus, tonight, she's here with Calvin, and she's got no business hitting on you. My tone was a lot angrier than I'd intended.
Oh.
Sam looked disconcerted.
But if you want to go out with her, go ahead, I said, trying to lighten up. I mean, she can't be all bad.
And I guess she thought she was doing the right thing, coming to help find information on a missing shifter.
That sounded pretty good, and might even be the truth.
I don't have to like who you date, I added, just to make it clear I understood I had no claim on him.
Yeah, but I feel better if you do, he said.
Same here, I agreed, to my own surprise.
Chapter 2. We began packing up in a quiet and unobtrusive way, since there were still lingering guests.
As long as we're talking about dates, what happened to Quinn?
He asked as we worked.
You've been moping ever since you got back from Rhodes.
Well, I told you he got hurt pretty bad in the bombing. Quinn's branch of EEE staged special events for the soup community. Vampire hierarchical weddings, wear coming-of-age parties, pack leader contests, and the like. That was why Quinn had been in the Pyramid of Giza when the Fellowship did its dirty deed. The FOTS people were anti-vampire, but they had no idea that vampires were just the visible public tip of the iceberg in the supernatural world. No one knew this, or at least only a few people like me, though more and more were in on the big secret. I was sure the Fellowship fanatics would hate werewolves or shapeshifters like Sam just as much as they hated vampires, if they knew they existed. That time might come soon.
Yeah, but I would have thought.
I know, I would have thought Quinn and I were all set too, I said, and if my voice was dreary, well, thinking about my missing were-tiger made me feel that way. I kept thinking I'd hear from him, but not a word.
You still got his sister's car?
Franny, Quinn, had loaned me her car so I could get home after the Rhodes disaster. No, it vanished one night when Amelia and I were both at work. I called and left a voicemail on his cell to say it had been taken, but I never heard back.
Sookie, I'm sorry,
Sam said. He knew that was inadequate, but what could he say? Yeah, me too, I said, trying not to sound too depressed. It was an effort to keep from retreading tired mental ground. I knew Quinn didn't blame me in any way for his injuries. I'd seen him in the hospital in Rhodes before I'd left, and he'd been in the care of his sister, Fran, who didn't seem to hate me at that point. No blame, no hate. Why no communication? It was like the ground had opened to swallow him up. I threw up my hands and tried to think of something else. Keeping busy was the best remedy when I was worried. We began to shift some of our things to Sam's truck, parked about a block away. He carried most of the heavier stuff. Sam is not a big guy, but he's really strong, as all shifters are. By 10:30, we were almost finished. From the cheers at the front of the house, I knew that the brides had descended the staircase in their honeymoon clothes, thrown their bouquets, and departed. Portia and Glenn were going to San Francisco, and Hallie and Andy were going to Jamaica to some resort. I couldn't help but know. Sam told me I could leave.
I'll get Dawson to help me unload at the bar, he said.
Since Dawson, who'd been standing in for Sam at Merlot's bar tonight, was built like a boulder, I agreed that was a good plan. When we divided the tips, I got about $300. It had been a lucrative evening. I tucked the money in my pants pocket. It made a big roll since it was mostly ones. I was glad we were in Bon Ton instead of a big city, or I'd worry that someone would hit me on the head before I got to my car. "Well, night, Sam," I said, and checked my pocket for my car keys. I hadn't bothered with bringing a purse. As I went down the slope of the backyard to the sidewalk, I patted my hair self-consciously. I'd been able to stop the pink smock lady from putting it on top of my head, so she'd done it puffy and curly and sort of Farrah Fawcett. I felt silly. There were cars going by, most of them wedding guests taking their departure. There was some regular Saturday night traffic. The line of vehicles, parked against the curb, stretched for a very long way down the street, so all traffic was moving slowly. I'd illegally parked with the driver's side against the curb, not usually a big deal in our little town. I bent to unlock my car door, and I heard a noise behind me. In a single movement, I palmed my keys and clenched my fist, wheeled, and hit as hard as I could. The keys gave my fist quite a core, and the man behind me staggered across the sidewalk to land on his butt on the slope of the lawn.
"I mean you no harm," said Jonathan.
It isn't easy to look dignified and non-threatening when you have blood running from one corner of your mouth and you're sitting on your ass, but the Asian vampire managed it. "You surprised me," I said, which was a gross understatement.
"I can see that,"
he said, and got easily to his feet. He brought out a handkerchief and patted his mouth. I wasn't going to apologize. People who sneak up on me when I'm alone at night, well, they deserve what they get. But I reconsidered. Vampires move quietly. "I'm sorry I assumed the worst," I said, which was sort of a compromise. "I should have identified you."
"No, it would have been too late by then," Jonathan said. "A woman alone must defend herself."
"I appreciate your understanding," I said carefully. I glanced behind him, tried not to register anything on my face. Since I hear so many startling things from people's brains, I'm used to doing that. I looked directly at Jonathan. Why were you here?"
"I'm passing through Louisiana, and I came to the wedding as a guest of Hamilton Thorpe," he said. "I'm staying in Area 5 with the permission of Eric Northman."
I had no idea who Hamilton Thorpe was, presumably some buddy of the Bellefleurs, but I knew Eric Northman quite well. In fact, at one time I'd known him from his head to his toes and all points in between. Eric was the sheriff of Area 5, a large chunk of northern Louisiana. We were tied together in a complex way, which most days I resented like hell. "Actually, what I was asking you was, why did you approach me just now?" I waited, keys still clutched in my hand. I'd go for his eyes, I decided. Even vampires are vulnerable there.
"I was curious,"
Jonathan said finally. His hands were folded in front of him. I was developing a strong dislike for the vamp. "Why?"
"I heard a little at Fantasia about the blonde woman Eric values so highly. Eric has such a hard nose that it didn't seem likely any human woman could interest him."
"So how'd you know I was going to be here, at this wedding, tonight?" His eyes flickered. He hadn't expected me to persist in questioning. He had expected to be able to calm me, maybe at this moment was trying to coerce me with his glamour, but that just didn't work on me.
"The young woman who works for Eric, his child, Pam, mentioned it," he said.
Liar, liar, pants on fire, I thought. I hadn't talked to Pam in a couple of weeks, and our last conversation hadn't been girlish chatter about my social and work schedule. She'd been recovering from the wounds she'd sustained in Rhodes.
Her recovery, and Eric's, and the Queen's, had been the sole topic of our conversation.
Of course, I said. Well, good evening. I need to be leaving.
I unlocked the door and carefully slid inside, trying to keep my eyes fixed on Jonathan so I'd be ready for a sudden move. He stood as still as a statue, inclining his head to me after I started the car and pulled off. At the next stop sign, I buckled my seatbelt. I hadn't wanted to pin myself down while he was so close. I locked the car doors, and I looked all around me. No vampires in sight. I thought, that was really, really weird. In fact, I should probably call Eric and relate the incident to him. You know what the weirdest part was? The withered man with the long blonde hair had been standing in the shadows behind the vampire the whole time. Our eyes had even met once. His beautiful face had been quite unreadable, but I'd known he didn't want me to acknowledge his presence. I hadn't read his mind, I couldn't, but I'd known this nonetheless. And weirdest of all, Jonathan hadn't known he was there. Given the acute sense of smell that all vampires possessed, Jonathan's ignorance was simply extraordinary. I was still mulling over the strange little episode when I turned off Hummingbird Road and onto the long driveway through the woods that led back to my old house. The core of the house had been built more than 160 years before, but of course very little of the original structure remained. It had been added to, remodeled, and re-roofed a score of times over the course of the decades. A two-room farmhouse to begin with, it was now much larger, but it remained a very ordinary home. Tonight the house looked peaceful in the glow of the outside security light that Amelia Broadway, my housemate, had left on for me. Amelia's car was parked in back, and I pulled alongside it. I kept my keys out in case she'd gone upstairs for the night. She'd left the screen door unlatched, and I latched it behind me. I unlocked the back door and relocked it. We were hell on security, Amelia and I, especially at night. A little to my surprise, Amelia was sitting at the kitchen table, waiting for me. We'd developed a routine after weeks of living together, and generally Amelia would have retired upstairs by this time. She had her own TV, her cell phone, and her laptop up there, and she'd gotten a library card, so she had plenty to read. Plus, she had her spell work, which I didn't ask questions about. Ever. Amelia is a witch. How'd it go? She asked, stirring her tea as if she had to create a tiny whirlpool. Well, they got married. No one pulled Jane Eyre. Glenn's vampire customers behaved themselves, and Miss Caroline was gracious all over the place. But I had to stand in for one of the bridesmaids.
Oh, wow, tell me.
So I did, and we shared a few laughs. I thought of telling Amelia about the beautiful man, but I didn't. What could I say? He looked at me. I did tell her about Jonathan from Nevada.
What do you think he really wanted? Amelia said.
I can't imagine. I shrugged.
You need to find out, especially since you've never heard of the guy whose guest he said he was.
I'm going to call Eric. If not tonight, then tomorrow night.
Too bad you didn't buy a copy of that database Bill is peddling. I saw an ad for it on the internet yesterday, on a vampire site.
This might seem like a sudden change of subject, but Bill's database contained pictures and/or biographies of all the vampires he'd been able to locate all over the world, and a few he just heard about. Bill's little CD was making more money for his boss, the Queen, than I could ever have imagined. But you had to be a vampire to purchase a copy, and they had ways of checking. Well, since Bill's charging $500 a pop and impersonating a vampire is a dangerous risk, I said. Amelia waved her hand. It'd be worth it, she said. Amelia is a lot more sophisticated than I am, at least in some ways. She grew up in New Orleans, and she'd lived there most of her life. Now she was living with me because she'd made a giant mistake. She needed to leave New Orleans after her inexperience had caused a magical catastrophe. It was lucky she'd departed when she had, because Katrina followed soon after. Since the hurricane, her tenant was living in the top-floor apartment of Amelia's house. Amelia's own apartment on the bottom floor had sustained some damage. She wasn't charging the tenant rent because he was overseeing the repair of the house. And here came the reason Amelia wasn't moving back to New Orleans anytime soon. Bob padded into the kitchen to say hello, rubbing himself affectionately against my legs.
"Hey, my little honey bunny," I said, picking up the long-haired black-and-white cat. "How's my precious? I love him."
"I'm gonna barf," Amelia said, but I knew that she talked just as disgustingly to Bob when I wasn't around. "Any progress?" I said, raising my head from Bob's fur. He'd had a bath this afternoon, I could tell from his fluffy factor. "No," she said, her voice flat with discouragement. "I worked on him for an hour today, and I only gave him a lizard tail. Took everything I had to get it changed back." Bob was really a guy, that is, a man. A sort of nerdy-looking man with dark hair and glasses, though Amelia had confided he had some outstanding attributes that weren't apparent when he was dressed for the street. Amelia wasn't supposed to be practicing transformational magic when she turned Bob into a cat. They were having what must have been very adventurous sex. I'd never had the nerve to ask her what she'd been trying to do. It was clear that it was something pretty exotic. "The deal is," Amelia said suddenly, and I went on the alert. The real reason she'd stayed up to see me was about to be revealed. Amelia was a very clear broadcaster, so I picked it right up from her brain. But I let her go on and speak, because people really don't like it if you tell them they don't have to actually speak to you, especially when the topic is something they've had to build up to. "My dad is going to be in Shreveport tomorrow, and he wants to come by Bon Ton to see me," she said in a rush. "It'll be him and his chauffeur, Marley. He wants to come for supper." The next day would be Sunday. Merlot's would be open only in the afternoon, but I wasn't scheduled to work anyway, I saw with a glance at my calendar. "So I'll just go out," I said. "I could go visit JB and Tara, no big."
"Please be here," she said, and her face was naked with pleading. She didn't spell out why, but I could read the reason easy enough. Amelia had a very conflicted relationship with her dad. In fact, she'd taken her mother's last name, Broadway, though in part that was because her father was so well known. Copley Carmichael had lots of political clout, and he was rich, though I didn't know how Katrina had affected his income. Carmichael owned huge lumber yards and was a builder, and Katrina might have wiped out his businesses. On the other hand, the whole area needed lumber and rebuilding.
"What time's he coming?" I asked.
5.
"Does the chauffeur eat at the same table as him?" I'd never dealt with employees. We just had the one table here in the kitchen. I sure wasn't going to make the man sit on the back steps.
"Oh, God," she said. This had clearly never occurred to her. "What will we do about Marley?"
"That's what I'm asking you." I may have sounded a little too patient.
"Listen," Amelia said. "You don't know my dad. You don't know how he is."
I knew from Amelia's brain that her feelings about her father were really mixed. It was very difficult to pick through the love, fear, and anxiety to get to Amelia's true, basic attitude. I knew few rich people, and even fewer rich people who employed full-time chauffeurs. This visit was going to be interesting. I said goodnight to Amelia and went to bed, and though there was a lot to think about, my body was tired and I was soon asleep. Sunday was another beautiful day. I thought of the newlyweds, safely launched on their new lives, and I thought of old Miss Caroline, who was enjoying the company of a couple of her cousins, youngsters in their 60s, by way of watchdogs and companions. When Portia and Glenn returned, the cousins would go back to their more humble home, probably with some relief. Hallie and Andy would move into their own small house. I wondered about Jonathan and the beautiful withered man. I reminded myself to call Eric the next night when he was up. I thought about Bill's unexpected words. For the millionth time, I speculated about Quinn's silence. But before I could get too broody, I was caught up in Hurricane Amelia. There are a lot of things I've come to enjoy, even love, about Amelia. She's straightforward, enthusiastic, and talented. She knows all about the supernatural world and my place in it. She thinks my weird talent is really cool. I can talk to her about anything. She's never going to react with disgust or horror. On the other hand, Amelia is impulsive and headstrong, but you have to take people like they are. I've really enjoyed having Amelia living with me. On the practical side, she's a decent cook. She's careful about keeping our property separate, and God knows she's tidy. What Amelia really does well is clean. She cleans when she's bored, she cleans when she's nervous, and she cleans when she feels guilty. I'm no slouch in the housekeeping department, but Amelia is world class. The day she had a near-miss auto accident, she cleaned my living room furniture, upholstery and all. When her tenant called her to tell her the roof had to be replaced, she went down to Easy Rent and brought home a machine to polish and buff the wooden floors upstairs and downstairs. When I got up at 9, Amelia was already deep in a cleaning frenzy because of her father's impending visit. By the time I left for church at about 10:45, Amelia was on her hands and knees in the downstairs hall bathroom, which admittedly is very old-fashioned looking, with its tiny octagonal black-and-white tiles and a huge old claw-footed bathtub. But, thanks to my brother Jason, it has a more modern toilet. This was the bathroom Amelia used, since there wasn't one upstairs. I had a small private one off my bedroom, added in the 50s. In my house, you could see several major decorating trends over the past few decades, all in one building. "You really think it was that dirty?" I said, standing in the doorway. I was talking to Amelia's rump. She raised her head and passed a rubber-gloved hand over her forehead to push her short hair out of the way. "No, it wasn't bad, but I want it to be great." "My house is just an old house, Amelia. I don't think it can look great." There was no point in my apologizing for the age and wear of the house and its furnishings. This was the best I could do, and I loved it. "This is a wonderful old home, Sookie," Amelia said fiercely, "but I have to be busy." "Okay," I said. "Well, I'm going to church. I'll be home by 12:30.
"Can you go to the store after church? The list is on the counter."
I agreed, glad to have something to do that would keep me out of the house longer. The morning felt more like March in the South, that is, than October. When I got out of my car at the Methodist church, I raised my face to the slight breeze. There was a touch of winter in the air, a little taste of it. The windows in the modest church were open. When we sang, our combined voices floated out over the grass and trees. But I saw some leaves blow past as the pastor preached. Frankly, I don't always listen to the sermon. Sometimes the hour in church is just time to think, a time to consider where my life is going. But at least those thoughts are in a context. And when you watch leaves falling off trees, your context gets pretty narrow. Today, I listened. Reverend Collins talked about giving God the things that were due him while giving Caesar the things due him. That sounded like an April 15th type sermon to me, and I caught myself wondering if Reverend Collins paid his taxes quarterly. But after a while, I figured he was talking about the laws we break all the time without feeling guilty, like the speed limit or sticking a letter in with some presents in a box you're mailing at the post office without paying the extra postage. I smiled at Reverend Collins on my way out of the church. He always looks a little troubled when he sees me. I said hello to Maxine Fortenberry and her husband Ed as I reached the parking lot. Maxine was large and formidable, and Ed was so shy and quiet, he was almost invisible. Their son, Hoyt, was my brother Jason's best friend. Hoyt was standing behind his mother. He was wearing a nice suit, and his hair had been trimmed. Interesting signs.
Sugar, you give me a big hug, Maxine said, and of course I did.
Maxine had been a good friend to my grandmother, though she was more the age my dad would have been. I smiled at Ed and gave Hoyt a little wave.
You're looking nice, I told him, and he smiled. I didn't think I'd ever seen Hoyt smile like that, and I glanced at Maxine. She was grinning.
Hoyt, he's dating that Holly you work with, Maxine said.
She's got a little one, and that's a thing to think about, but